This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, FSTV Easy on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The largest concentration of poverty, homelessness, and policing in the U.S. lies in a 50-block neighborhood in one of the nation's largest metropolises. Skid Row is the accepted name for the area of Los Angeles that pushes against the city's political center and its rapidly gentrifying downtown. And while there have been millions of dollars spent on, quote, cleaning up Skid Row, little seems to change. Is that by design? A sociologist who spent 5 years among Skid Row residents has now written a definitive book about policing and homelessness that could offer lessons from many similar areas in American cities. Forrest Stewart is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, and his book is called Down, Out, and Under Arrest: How Policing the Homeless Hampers Their Well-Being. Welcome to the program, Forrest.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. What led you first into Skid Row to begin with? I understand you were studying in LA at the time.
Right. So actually, I came to Skid Row from a lot of work that I was doing in prisoners advocacy. So I was actually working in minimum security prisons with prisoners just before they were released. And after I had moved to Skid Row and begun school in Skid Row, I had heard of, in Los Angeles, I had heard about Skid Row. And this seemed like the kind of perfect place to really think about this kind of American narrative, this bootstrap story, right? So this was an area that has the largest concentration of returning prisoners and parolees and probationers, people who are kind of starting at square one from rock bottom. So it was really, really kind of a test and a question about, okay, can people really claw themselves up from the gutter? Can people really lift themselves up by their bootstraps? As I write in the book, it's a pretty perilous journey, and the outlook is not so great right now.
And so before we get into some of these stories, how long did you actually spend on Skid Row? How did you befriend people and convince them to even trust you?
Right. So I was on Skid Row for about 5 years. This was an everyday thing. So somewhere between 10 and 30 hours per week I spent in the neighborhood. And initially it was actually kind of a hard road to build the trust with residents. So I know, you know, this is a population that, as I write about, is incredibly paranoid about policing. And so there was a lot of question about whether or not I was an undercover cop, right? The same things that researchers do are the same things that undercover cops do, right? So asking people about their biographies, asking people about where they live, asking people about, you know, what they do every day. People were really suspicious, right? I'm there standing on the corner taking notes, right? I'm asking a lot of probing questions. These are the kinds of things that undercover cops do. After time, just after being in the neighborhood for a really long time and establishing some contacts with some people who could vouch for my identity and my sincerity and my trustworthiness, eventually I began to make my way into a lot of different peer groups, a lot of different organizations, and I was finally able to kind of be trusted. And you know, now I go down the street and see tons of folks that I know, and I'm recognized, and it's a very different situation now.
So let's go through some of the stories that you tell that are illustrative of how hard it is to fix your life, if you will. You open your book talking about a man named Daryl. Tell us, take us briefly through his journey, how he ended up on Skid Row, and then how his attempts to find a home and a job continually got hampered by repeat arrests.
Right. And I think I start the book with Daryl's story precisely because it really captures everything that's going on in Skid Row, why people end up there, what they face there, and how policing continues to kind of knock them down and kind of cut those proverbial bootstraps. So Daryl is a vet. He's a veteran. He did quite a bit of military service, and he was living in South LA, South Central LA, kind of working a part-time job, just kind of barely making his rent. You know, he was suffering from PTSD, a lot of depression, and he lost his part-time job. And so he went down to the VA office and was hoping to get some kind of relief from there. He wasn't really able to pay his rent anymore. And the VA actually sent him to Skid Row, right? They said, there's nothing we can do for you as a veteran. You're not quite messed up enough for us to activate services. So we're going to send you down to these flop house hotels and these homeless shelters, essentially, in Skid Row, because there's nothing we can do for you here. So Daryl made his way to Skid Row, and right, this is a 50 block area that is the poorest, one of the poorest locations in the entire United States. And he was able to sometimes afford a weekly hotel. Other times he was forced to sleep on the street. And this is when I had met him. We had met in the park. I'd started playing dominoes in the park to meet a lot of people. He started to come there as well. And we kind of became quick friends. And he used to scavenge, right? He was now scavenging. So he was pushing a shopping cart every day through the alleys of Skid Row, picking up things to recycle. And he was getting by, slightly getting by, but all this changed when he began having run-ins with the police. And this is a story that happens over and over and over again. So I believe
means simply that he was just standing or sitting on the sidewalk.
Right. So it was actually, Daryl was, his first big run-in with police was that he was sitting on the sidewalk, which in Los Angeles is actually illegal. It's a misdemeanor. LA Municipal Code 4118D says that you can actually be put into handcuffs and taken down to the station and booked for sitting on the sidewalk. And this was his first run-in with police. He's, you know, in between one of his big hauls. He spent the day trying to scrape up enough money to survive, you know, diving into dumpsters. He's tired and smelling and frustrated, and he's just sitting on the sidewalk to catch a break. And the police come up and they arrest him. They give him tickets. Another time he's
and then tied to the tickets is what? What did the police tell him he has to do? They're not just arresting him for this misdemeanor. They are requiring him to attend a program.
Absolutely. So this is something new that cities like LA, San Francisco has some programs like this. I think New York may be instituting some programs like this. Essentially, part of a program called Streets or Services, the police essentially give people this really coercive ultimatum, right? So first they prohibit all kinds of innocent behaviors, I think, like sitting on the sidewalk. They arrested Daryl, like many others. They took him down to the station. They said, look, you've got a choice. One, you can either go through the booking process and spend a few nights in jail, or in this next room, there's a caseworker who works for one of these social service agencies that are in the area, and that caseworker will walk you directly into a 21-day program. So you have a choice, either get yourself into a program, into one of these organizations, or go to jail. A lot of people choose the 21-day program. Folks like Daryl have chosen the 21-day program, but they find that these are places that are
you say choose, but if the only other option is jail, it's not really much of a choice.
Right. No, it's not much of a choice at all. It's not much of a choice at all. But what's interesting though is that I've in talking to a lot of residents who selected the option to go into one of these services, they oftentimes say they wish they would have just chosen jail.
Right.
I think that this really, I think we have to put these services in context, that people are actually after the fact, right, after they leave these services after a couple days because they're coercive and infantilizing and sometimes sexually abusive, that some people are actually saying, wow, I would have been better off if I just took 2 days in jail. So you're right. So these options aren't necessarily options whatsoever.
Right. And so then arrest after arrest resulted in Daryl being, fined, having arrest warrants, and basically any attempt that he made to get out of Skid Row, to find a home, to find a job, were being pushed away or being destroyed by cops, right, under the pretext of cops thinking they were helping him, but they weren't.
Right. So I think, so just to kind of touch on that first part of what you said, I think for a lot of us, certainly for me, I can only speak for myself, right? I get a ticket, it's an annoyance, I pay it, I go on with my life. For people like Daryl, for, you know, the 15,000 people living in Skid Row, and for poor people across the country, right, that $100, that $200 ticket for for walking on a red light or jaywalking or littering or loitering or sitting on the sidewalk, right? If you're living on fixed income, if you're living on general assistance for $200 a month, it's pretty hard to pay a $150 ticket. So that oftentimes turns into a $500 fine, it turns into a warrant, and then every single further contact you have with police just brings harsher and harsher penalties, right? So you end up in this hole that is being dug by officers. And I'm glad you brought up the kind of the perspective of officers, because I got to know a lot of officers. And so when I first came into Skid Row and I was watching what policing was doing to people, you know, it's really easy to envision officers as these cold-hearted, kind of stormtrooper-esque people kind of, you know, walking throughout the neighborhood, wanting to make life as terrible as possible for poor folks. But this was not actually what was going on. I met actually a lot of compassionate, do-gooder cops who wanted to help people. But the problem was, right, when they encountered folks who needed help, they didn't have the tools to help them, right? So
and all they had were these rehabilitation programs that they were told they can offer to the folks being arrested as an option, as another option to jail.
Right, so they have those, and then they've also got their handcuffs, right? So a lot of officers thought, hey, you know, if I can make Skid Row, if I can make this poor neighborhood as uncomfortable as possible for the people living here, they will somehow kind of mysteriously choose, right, not to be poor, not to be unemployed.
Because money will apparently mysteriously appear in their pockets.
So unfortunately, this was the perspective of a lot of people patrolling. But I mean, I think we should be, you know, somewhat sympathetic to the individuals who are tasked with this particular role, right? So we've hollowed out the welfare state. We've essentially said the police are going to be our frontline social service agents.
They're right, and so frontline police so instead officers. Of pouring money into things that might actually work, well, first figuring out what homeless people want in Skid Row, and then actually pouring money into that, what is the city has done, and what I think a lot of cities have done, is to pour money into these. For in these rehabilitation programs that don't necessarily work and that people are essentially forced into, and into simply having more police. And something
that you found out
over your 5 years, you were arrested how many times?
So I was stopped by, so in my first year alone in Skid Row, I was stopped by the police 14 times.
Wow. And for doing what?
For standing on a corner, for just kind of being in the neighborhood. I remember kind of the most memorable one. I had befriended a group of street vendors who, you know, for a living, they hawked CDs and DVDs on a street corner. And, you know, one night, late at night, officers came through and, you know, jumped out of their car on me, threw me up against a fence, rifled through my bag. And I, just for standing there, you know, I was told that I fit the description of someone distributing narcotics. You know, anyone who kind of has dealt with police frequently knows that this is often just a justification for making contact with people.
And for our radio audience, by the way, I mean, I should say you are a slightly brown-skinned man. I don't know if that played into it.
Actually, I'm for people listening on radio, I'm half black. So I'm certainly a lighter shade of brown than most of the folks living in Skid Row, but it turned out this was actually one of the reasons why the police stopped me. So it turns out that whiteness and lighter skinned people are deemed especially suspicious in Skid Row.
Wow.
Right. So this is one of the things we see quite often around the country with the effects of gentrification. So downtown Los Angeles is quickly gentrifying, which is right next to Skid Row. And so the police actually are on the lookout for gentrifiers who are essentially have lost their way or are trespassing, right? Either looking to score drugs or kind of looking to slum it. And so officers actually direct a lot of attention to people who appear out of place in this criminalized black space. And I'll say in a criminalized male space, because women are actually some of the most frequented targets of the police, right? So women are by default in this space suspected of prostitution. Women in this space are constantly being put up against the wall, handcuffed, questioned, asked if they're working, as in, are you working the street? And it actually leads a lot of men in this space to be incredibly distrustful of women, right? Because if you're seen being too friendly with a woman, if you're seen flirting with a woman, sometimes even with your wife, I tell a story in my book of a married couple who are stopped continually by the police because they suspect him of soliciting prostitution and are actually made to prove to the officers that they're married. So we see the ways in which policing becomes racialized, how policing takes on a gender component in spaces like this that are hyper policed.
So Forrest, what has the city of Los Angeles done to deal with Skid Row? It's just often dismissed as getting in the way of the push for gentrification, a stain on the city's reputation. But has the city ever really tried to determine what homeless, mentally ill, or drug addicted residents of Skid Row need and actually gone about trying to address it? Or have they simply thrown more police into this 50 block square area of the city?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's the latter. So unfortunately, it continues to come back to policing. Year after year, I think election season after election season, there are all kinds of statements made by politicians that we're going to get more compassionate services, that more services and more millions of dollars are going to be delivered. But when the time comes to actually put those policies into motion, you know, the money somehow makes its way over to policing, and we just see a continued intensification from the city side. I would say, luckily, there is a good amount of movement from organizations on the ground who I think get this stuff. So there are a few organizations who are really embracing the housing first and harm reduction model. So essentially, the model that's in place right now that the city is embracing, that you know a lot of organizations are embracing in Skid Row, that I actually think is not doing a lot of good, is asking people to essentially become better citizens before they can get any kinds of services, right? So demonstrate to us that you can be sober for 6 months, or demonstrate to us that you have a good work ethic, and then we'll begin to give you services. So Housing First and Harm Reduction, which some new organizations are taking up, says, no, look, the first thing we need to do is put a roof over people's heads. We need to make people feel secure. We need to make people feel cared for. We need to make people feel as though they have a community that they can trust. And then we're going to do wraparound services. We're going to put caseworkers here. We're going to meet people where they are and begin to gradually, try to reintegrate folks, deal with mental illness, deal with substance abuse. And it turns out, I think people are kind of startled when I say the cost savings of doing so. So currently, the model that we're using right now, these figures are insane, costs us about $3,000 per person per month from the city budget.
If this is to police them and to have all these other sort of things that don't work.
Right. So that's for our current model. If we just stay the course, it's going to cost us about $3,000 per person per month. If we were to move systematically to a housing first, a harm reduction supportive housing model, which thankfully some organizations are beginning to do, we would take that $3,000 down to $600 per person per month. So not only is it more efficient, it's more cost effective. You know, at this point in time, it's practically paying for itself.
And this also just goes to show how it's almost as though we deliberately do not want to understand the things that make people homeless, because it's easier to blame them for being addicted to drugs, to losing their jobs, to being homeless. Recently on our show, we had covered a story of universal basic income, and our author cited a study in England where a number of homeless people were simply given a big chunk of money, not a very big chunk of money, but a modest chunk of money. And a year later, it was sort of shocking that most of them have gotten on their feet, because that one chunk of money actually helped them dig themselves out of the hole that they had been thrust into by society. And so it's just really remarkable that these cheaper alternatives that do work are the ones that we tend to use the least. Well, Forrest, any last thoughts on how what you've learned can be applied in other parts of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this move toward housing first, harm reduction, and permanent supportive housing. I think if we are going to solve this problem, if we're going to build a more equitable country and more equitable society, then we've got to make that move. And without doing so, things are not going to change. And it really does take a kind of reworking of our moralizing of poverty. It means a reworking of how we imagine the causes of poverty and how we imagine poor people more generally. And I think you're right on. So I think if anything, it would be we need to continue pushing for these more efficient solutions.
Forrest Stewart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Forrest Stewart is my guest. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. His book is called Down, Out, and Under Arrest: How Policing the Homeless Hampers Their Well-Being. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Twitter at twitter.com/RU with Sonali.